Welcome to Rocking Your Prize. I'm your host, Dr. Alice Evans. Now, here is a question for you. Who are the world's most influential philosophers? Ghazali, Tusi, Rumi, and Duani are among the most influential philosophers in the world, I'd suggest. Yet, curiously unknown in the West, these Islamic Persian ethicists were championed by Seljuk, Ottoman, Timurid, Safavid, and Mughal rulers who controlled vast empires. Imperial expansion was a crucial driver of cultural evolution, and it explains why parts of the world today are still so gender unequal. In this podcast today, I want to explore their global influence and moral philosophies. Warning, for those of a sensitive disposition, I will also be discussing violent bestial sex. Okay, so Ghazali, Tusi, Rumi, and Zamani were all patronized by powerful empires. Tusi's Akhlaq e-Nazari, written in the 13th century, entered South Asia with the Timurids and became a favorite reading of the Mughal political elites. Mughal Emperor Akbar further instructed his officials to read both Tusi and Rumi. By the 17th century, Tusi's Akhlaq was part of the Mughal madrasa syllabi. Now, Rumi's Masnavi, 13th century, is the Sufi's most influential text. Seljuk, Ottoman, Timurid, Safavid, and Mughal rulers all lavished him with praise. Emperor Akbar regularly recited Rumi's Masnavi. Rumi continues to be widely revered. His ornate tomb in Konya, which of course I've been to, attracts 1.5 million pilgrims a year. Ghazali, from the 12th century, was heralded as an authority of Islam, proof of Islam. It's called Hujjat al-Islam. His moral and political philosophy was institutionalized by the Ottoman Empire. Translated into Turkish, it was frequently discussed and commented upon. Ghazali's wisdom was heavily cited in policy advice to Ottoman rulers. Now, Turkish polymath Katib Çelebi in the late 17th century declared, "If all other Islamic books disappeared, leaving only Ghazali's Ihya, it would be sufficient." His knowledge was deemed sufficient. It's all you need to know. He was referring to Ghazali. So dissent was repressed. Books of Ghazali's critics, like Ibn Rushd, could not even be found in the famous Seyyid Al-Pasa library. Mehmed Semsedin, that's a 19th century professor of Islamic history, argued that Muslim philosophy was gravely punched, merciless and effective strokes by al-Ghazali. Ottoman scholars had to toe the line. "Heterodox Muslims should be culled," says Ghazali. As Timur Kuran explains, Ghazali helped to establish the practice of treating heterodox Muslims as apostates who deserved execution. He urged the killing of independent philosophers as well as Ismaili Shi'is, insisting that rulers and their military had a duty to destroy heretics. The fatwas of leading Islamic interpreters such as Ghazali were collected in volumes for use by later interpreters, statesmen, and judges. So their rule predominated. So Ghazali, Tusi, Rumi, and Devani's Islamic ethics were propagated across Anatolia, North Africa, Central Asia, and South Asia. So what did they say about gender? Well, in brief, they declared that men are intellectually superior and men alone cultivate ethical refinement. The ideal wife is pious, fertile, secluded, and obedient. Men cultivate ethical refinement by keeping their wives subservient, veiled, and secluded. Now, you may ask about, well, what about women's earlier freedoms? I'll come to that. Now, women did have some authority over the household, but that's really just the daily minutiae. In terms of love and loyalty, these Persian theologians revered filial piety as the highest form of piety, akin to godliness, whereas marital love was actually discouraged. They also praised male homosocial love. Now, interestingly, they also said that justice, and I quote, requires that each one stay in his rank. They did not support social mobility. Finally, I'll discuss towards the end that they thought that public life and politics were men's domain. Now, In researching this podcast, I've drawn heavily on Zahra Ayyoubi's brilliant analysis of Ghazali, Tusi and Devani's philosophies in her book Gendered Morality. I also incorporate my own reading of Rumi's Masnavi Book 5 and also my interviews with leading Sufi sheikhs and Muslims in many parts of the world. That is Morocco, Egypt, Uzbekistan, Indonesia, Pakistan and India. And if you turn to the Substack version of this podcast, you'll see some beautiful colour paintings from Tusi's Akhlaq Nasiri, which were commissioned for the Mughal Emperor Akbar. Those are I'd recommend having a look at those, if only to scroll through, because they shed light on how Tusi's theology was embraced by Mughals. So they highlight cultural transmission. Okay, so the first and most important point, men are intellectually superior, and men alone cultivate ethical refinement. Ghazali, Tusi, and Devani all thought that women had souls, but were overly emotional and intellectually deficient. Accordingly, explains Zahra Ayyoubi, they should be ruled by men. Moral advice was directed at men because they were seen as intellectually superior. Ayyoubi details that for Ghazali, Tusi and Devani, ethical refinement was for men alone. Now, Rumi similarly likened women to donkeys. And I quote, this is a direct quote, "She shares that poor donkey's acinity. Animal qualities prevail in them. They're drawn," that is women, "they're drawn to scent and colour in this realm. And that's the Masnavi Book 5 and lines 2465. Now, after likening women to donkeys, Rumi repeatedly reminds his audience that if donkeys are seized or killed, one needn't worry, since you're not a donkey. Okay, moving on. Now, the ideal wife. Piety, virginity, fertility, sexual submissiveness and obedience were repeatedly emphasized by Ghazali, Tusi and Devani. Women's chief role was to reproduce. Let me quote from Ayyoubi. "According to the ethicists, a wife should humble herself like a little concubine." Tusi apparently used the diminutive form kanizak. And they recommend, and I quote, "they recommend that a husband strategically show or withhold benevolence in order to coerce the wife into submission." In Mughal Emperor Akbar's copy of Tusi's Akhlaq, there are only two pictures of women, and one of them glorifies motherly love, which you can see on my Substack. Okay, so men cultivated ethical refinement by keeping their wives subservient, veiled, and secluded. For Tusi, the wife's appearance in public is inextricable from the husband's masculinity, explains Zahra Ayyoubi. The ethicists state that a husband should undertake great endeavours to keep his wife in curtain and veil, that is satar wa hijab, and away from non-kinsmen, gaya mahram or na mahram, in order to shield her from people who might tempt her, and vice versa. The man should prevent his wife from meeting male strangers, carrying on with strange men through window peepholes or on rooftops, attending superfluous social gatherings and even talking to older women who no longer veil and who recount stories about the social scene. Women should be secluded. Satan is searching for ways to corrupt men and draw them away from God. He rejoiced when he discovered the most powerful trap, a woman's beauty, explained Rumi in the Masnavi Book 5. But carnal pleasures are only temporary, and their pursuit always results in abject humiliation. Let me quote from Rumi again. "Nothing's worse than lust for you. It has disgraced so many reputations, made fools of millions of intelligent ones." That's again Book 5. Then Rumi gives multiple warning stories, including one about a woman who desired a donkey. Now brace yourselves. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. This is graphic. Ready? You have your option to turn off now. Okay. This is from Rumi. The donkey's penis grew erect and stiffer. It thrust in her and spread a fire within her. The well-trained donkey pushed in all the way, up to its balls, and she died straight away. The penis in her made her liver tear. Her intestines were also torn in there, and she said nothing. On the spot she died. The chair fell one aside, she the other side. The room was soaked in blood. What a bad state! The woman fell down dead. Unfortunate fate. A bad death with so much disgrace. Oh, father! She was a donkey's penis, frail martyr. Heed the Quran, the torment of disgrace. Don't lose your life through such a fall from grace. The donkey is the carnal soul to be, and it is more shameful, obviously. If you die for the carnal soul, be sure you're like this woman who was so impure. That's a direct quote. Okay, well, on the day of judgment, extramarital sex will be punished. Don't lose your life through such a fall from grace. Don't quit the weighing scales because of greed. Both lust and greed are foes that will mislead, said Rumi. To prevent sin, Rumi emphasizes that one must impose restraints and restrictions on the metaphorical donkey, that is the thing that attracts you. And he endorsed tent-like veiling. Now, men are presented as intellectually superior. But nonetheless, for Rumi, they were prone to these satanic temptations. Men's libido is frail and vulnerable. That's a direct quote. Tusi similarly encouraged men to protect their women folk from other men's lust. Now, by repeatedly emphasizing men's inability to control their sexual urges, Rumi may have cultivated distrust of other men, perpetuated anxiety over one's womenfolk, and encouraged cloistering. It sharply contrasts with 17th century Sweden, which actually embraced nude mixed-sex saunas. Okay, now you may think, but what about women's earlier freedoms? Now, Islamic feminists note that the Prophet's first wife, Khadija, was a successful trader. Nevin Rida insists that at the time of the Prophet, women had full access to major mosques and prayed next to men without any barriers or separate entrances. But, as Ayubi explains, Ghazali insisted that female seclusion was necessary to restore proper piety. And I quote, Ghazali quotes Umar ibn al-Khattab, who said that the Prophet allowed women to go into public bath in the days when they used to veil properly. But if he saw the women of today, he would rescind that permission. Ghazali then states, there is greater harm to women at public sites and gatherings than in the past. Ghazali echoes the common argument of the ulama, lamenting the golden era in which women knew how to conduct themselves properly in public. I quote Ayubi. Now, women still had some authority and autonomy, but it was sort of the boring stuff. So Ghazali, Tusi and Diwani suggested that women could exercise domestic authority, such as over the household's financial budget. But Ayubi suggests that men may have just been outsourcing, you know, the sort of daily minutiae, such as ensuring that kids ate their supper, did their chores and completed their lessons. Nothing big or fancy, nothing that gave status. Tusi still maintained that wives must obey and hand over their any wealth. I quote, a wife is content with whatever the husband gives her and forgives whatever the husband keeps from her and does not give her and also does not refuse him her own wealth. That's an important insight about patriarchy. Today, some people downplay or even deny gender inequalities by insisting that women exercise domestic authority. But this is compatible with an ideology in which men are revered as intellectual superiors, owed obedience, and are uniquely capable of spiritual refinement. Moreover, as I'll come to, the public sphere was reserved for men. Okay, filial piety, this is important. Filial piety was revered as godliness, as the greatest form of ethical refinement. Honouring and obeying one's parents was repeatedly extolled. Ghazali emphasized, doing good deeds for one's mother and father is better than prayer, fasting, pilgrimage, and just struggle. That is Ghazal. Marital love, by contrast, was discouraged. I quote, "The ethics of marriage have very little to do with love," explained Ayyubi. "The ethicists' scrupulous effort to describe for men how they ought to control their wives is rooted in their anxiety that men could be manipulated by the sentiment of love into losing their power to women." Ayyubi details that for Tusi, and I quote, "husbands should guard against showing excessive love, which should cause the wife to expect to dominate over her husband, a grave corruption," end quote. Tusi also provides a list of those whom an ethical man should love, and this list excludes women, says Ayyubi. That's crucial. As I've previously argued, romantic love is a major driver of gender equality, as it means mutual desire for each other's happiness. Patrilineal societies tend to suffocate marital love, as it draws men away from their proper loyalties to kin and the male brotherhood. Sons overriding obedience to their mothers and lesser concerns for their wives also enables mothers-in-law to be tyrannical, abusive, and exploitative. If men are not encouraged or given opportunities to form loving relationships with their wives, then they may not necessarily empathize with her wants or welfare, nor feel remorse about being violently abusive or controlling. Okay, now male homosocial love was praised. Ayyubi explains that Ghazali, Tusi, and Devani repeatedly celebrated male homosocial love. Quoting several hadith, Ghazali deemed male friendships more important than wives because men were intellectual equals who helped cultivate each other's spiritual refinement. And that's a hugely important insight, and it is overlooked by most studies on gender. By socializing together, men build trust, friendships, and loyalty. They come to respect and rely on each other's advice. In trust-based societies where government, commercial, and political networks all rely on who you know, Huasta in Arabic, or Ab Kiska Janteho in Urdu, I apologize for my pronunciation, these fraternal ties of trust consolidate men's advantage. So politics and public life were men's domain. Court was to be a man's world, insisted Ghazali, Tusi, and Devani. As each of the illustrations on my Substack show, the Mughal world really regarded the public community as male. Equally important here are religious rituals. Religious rituals played a crucial role in strengthening feelings of unity, trust, and social cohesion, as you may recall from my wonderful podcast with Robin Dunbar. Or I should say my podcast with the wonderful Robin Dunbar. Go for the more self-deprecating version, right? Okay, so congregational worship is repeatedly praised in both the Quran and Hadith. Let me quote one. "The reward of congregational prayer is 27 times greater than the prayer offered by one person alone." End quote. Muslim men are strongly encouraged to pray together, and that may have reinforced bonds of brotherhood. At the time of the Prophet, women may have had full access to major mosques and prayed next to men without any barriers or separate entrances. However, the hadith still imposed restrictions to prevent lusty temptations. Women's admittance to the mosque was apparently conditional on them not wearing perfumes and being veiled. Furthermore, several hadiths say that it is more meritworthy for a woman to pray at home, especially in that discreet portion of the home. So over time, piety increasingly came to require gender segregation, and the mosques were reserved for men. And that may have encouraged fraternal solidarity and cohesion. Now, across the Islamic world today, men are much more likely to attend religious services. Male-only religious rituals may have strengthened brotherly love and loyalty. In mosques where men pray alone or listen to the Friday sermon, khutbah, men alone are receiving ethical advice, just as advised by the Persian theologians. Now, let me make a final point. Justice requires that each one stay in his rank, says Tusi and Devani. Now, no matter someone's intellect, they were supposed to stay in their rank. Social mobility was firmly rejected by the Akhlaq texts, explains Ayubi. Tusi and Devani both said justice requires that each one stay in his rank and not transgress that rank. Now, that sharply contrasts with East Asian ideals of upward mobility, reverence for education, and desire for economic prosperity. However, it is perfectly consistent with South Asia's pre-existing caste system. Now, more gender-equal Muslim minorities have been repressed. In Turkey today, Alevi Shiites versus Sunni, men are much more likely to endorse gender equality, and Alevi women are much more likely to work. In the Alevi Sema rituals, women and men dance together. So that reflects greater liberalism without strictures of female seclusion. However, this more gender-equal Muslim sect has been repeatedly persecuted by the Ottoman Empire and contemporary Turkish government, which still does not recognize their houses of worship. Now, without violent repression, this more gender-equal Muslim sect could have achieved greater prominence and popularity. In Pakistan today, Ahmadis tend to be more progressive, but have been oppressed. In 1974, Pakistan's parliament declared them to be non-Muslim. They are not allowed to proselytize, gather other people, nor are they allowed to call their places of worship mosques. And when applying for a national ID card, Pakistanis must call Ahmadis non-Muslim. So let me summarize. Ghazali, Tusi, Rumi, and Devani are some of the most influential philosophers in human history. Ottoman, Safavid, Timurid, and Mughal emperors propounded their ideals of female seclusion. So forget all those theories of geography or technology, whatever. This is all about culture and conquest. It is this history of military conquest and imperial expansion, hitched to moral philosophies of male honor, alongside fears of lust and sexual predation, that explains why female employment and political participation remain so low in South Asia, the Middle East, Central Asia, and North Africa today. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Alice Evans, and this is Rocking Our Prayers. Take care.